Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Everybody, and welcome to this brand new spoiler review episode of Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, brought to you live from the
Geek Buddies.
Well, after 10 years at the beginning of starting with the Man of Steel in 2013, we have finally reached the end of the DCEU as we look forward to Superman Legacy coming out in 2025, or so we think. I mean, depending on if Universal buys Warner Brothers or not. But yeah, at this point, this is the end of the DCEU officially. Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, although they haven't officially said he's going to play Lobo, it's pretty clear that Momoa is moving on to play Lobo. So this was his last stab at playing Aquaman. This also saw the return of James Wan, the return of a number of actors who were part of the first one, and some new additions and an interesting story for us to break it all down. But we are here with a spoiler review of Aquaman and Lost Kingdom. And before we jump into it, though, let's introduce ourselves. I am the Outlaw John Ruka, writer, producer, and host here on The Geek Buddies.
I am Michael Vogel. I'm a writer and producer of animated TV shows and movies.
And this is Shannon McClung. I'm a television actor and an animation writer and an unapologetic Aquaman fan.
The character or the series?
We'll get to it.
Fair point. And since we are live, ladies and gentlemen, the Streamlabs and the Super Chats are open. Feel free to send in your Super Chats or Streamlabs to support the channel as we go along here. If you want to send in support after we're done, you're watching this later, there's a Super Thanks button down there you can hit as well. I am wearing the official Superman and Superman and the Lost Kingdom paraphernalia.
Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom.
Oh, sorry. Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. I don't know. You get one hero, you get them all. But yeah, they sent me this nice jacket, but unfortunately, I'm not going to be so positive about the movie, spoiler alert, but I am going to wear the jacket to support them sending this thing. So yeah, go ahead.
Mike. I didn't like your movie, but I'll wear your merch.
That's a fair point. And you know, it's an evening review, so we're going to have some fun for sure. But let's get into it. Michael, you know, I love to go to you first here. Here's the quick synopsis. Arthur Curry is the king of Atlantis and a husband and a dad, but it's the king stuff that's driving him insane. Then we get the lingering threat of Black Manta, who still wants vengeance for the death of his dad. He steals his son, who apparently can already communicate with the fishes, and which leads to Aquaman with the approval of Atlanta teaming up with Brother Orm to go and take down Black Manta and this weird king from the missing seventh kingdom here. Randall Park is back, shenanigans ensue. They basically rip off Thor and Loki, and we get to the end here, and I'm Aquaman. So, Michael, your thoughts on this movie here?
My first thought is, of all of the synopses you've ever done on Geek Buddies, that might be one of your best. That was spicy. It was a spicy synopsis. What did I think of Aquaman 2? There's two things that pop into mind is like my overall thoughts of Aquaman 2. One is, even more so than Aquaman 1, I actually think they had a lot of really good ideas. Oh. I think there was a lot of cool ideas in this movie. I think some of the ideas for the set pieces were cool. Wanting to tell this brother buddy story. I think there was a lot of really good ideas. Don't think any of them were particularly executed well. And it almost kind of felt, and I don't know if this is a little bit of just knowing where we are in the DC universe, it just kind of felt like they gave up a little bit somewhere in there. Like, they were just making the movie and they were doing the reshoots, but it just felt as aimless as the DCEU was. Like, it just kind of felt like they were trying to tell this big and epic story and have a lot of fun, but it just didn't seem like it had the energy to get there by the end. Like, it just kind of felt a little bit of a slog. But I think that Jason Momoa, who, as we've said, you know, not my particularly favorite take of Aquaman, and I'm not the hugest fan of the DC universe that we've had, but I thought he was generally pretty charming. I think he was charming in Justice League. I think it was charming every time he showed up, and I think this was kind of his least charming. It felt forced. It even felt from him that it was like he kind of knew it was coming to an end, and even his like, hey, I'm just having a good time, I'm Aquaman, I'm not a good king, but I'm just kind of having a good, like, it felt like he was pushing it. So look, do I think this is like the worst movie ever made? No, I can list a bunch of other movies that are way worse.
We'll talk about
that are currently out right now. But for Aquaman, it just kind of just felt like it was trudging to the end.
Okay, all right, Shannon, your thoughts overall on this one? We had James Wan coming back to direct this one. Same screenwriter, David Leslie Johnson McGoldrick, coming back to write this one as well. But this one was based on a story co-conceived by James Wan, Jason Momoa, and Thomas Ba'a-Sibet. So what are your thoughts on this particular movie, brother?
So more than likely, over the course of this evening, you all are going to throw out some critical feedback of this film. And more than likely, I am not going to disagree with one thing that you say.
Oh, well.
That being said however... I actually had a lot of fun in this movie. I mean, I don't think this is a good movie. I think this is definitely going to fall in the category of guilty pleasures. Yeah. Not only will I probably see it again in the theater, I probably buy it. One, because it's an Aquaman movie, and Lord knows when we're going to get another Aquaman movie. I actually had a lot of fun. I mean, looking at the four DC films that we got, this is right up there with Blue Beetle for me. I mean, I think a lot of the action, I think James Wan learned a lot of lessons from the first one. I think every action sequence in the first film started the same with the unexpected explosion. And so much so that Jason Momoa actually references it for a moment in one of the action scenes because they only did it once, which is like, yeah, that's growth. However... there is a whole lot going on in that script.
Yeah.
And to the point that it's like, individually, all of these are pretty interesting ideas. I think you're trying to put too much stuff together that doesn't necessarily quite fit. And I do agree with my my fellow geek buddy Mike Vogel. I mean, I do think there are limits to Jason Momoa's charm. That it was a little, it felt like he was kind of running out of gas at the end. Yeah. I will say the savior of this movie was Patrick Wilson.
100%.
And I 100% will take a road trip movie with Jason Momoa and Patrick Wilson over a road trip movie with Jason Momoa and Amber Heard. I think this is where this one really, really succeeded. Patrick Wilson just did. He was doing the Lord's work in this movie. I mean, he was doing the heavy lifting. Yeah. And honestly, like by the end, like I thought the tag was dumb and unnecessary. But the moment at the end where he's taking a bite of that burger, I'm like, that's great. But yeah, I mean, this is going to be guilty pleasure. I mean, I think a lot of the action worked well. And I think there was a lot of stuff that didn't work well, but Vogel was sitting next to me. I was laughing, having a blast.
Interesting. Okay. I saw this in 3D at, the press screening that they had for us down here. And I have to say this, it was nowhere near as offensively boring as the first movie was. Like the first movie, I had my eyes rolling so far out of my head. I almost died. It was so just nonsense, utter nonsense. And I think the biggest thing was that I really felt no one was good acting-wise in that first movie other than Nicole Kidman, who giving certain moments to really show what she could do. The bro stuff I thought worked funnily as a juxtaposition to Batman, Ben Affleck's Batman in Justice League. I didn't like it necessarily in its own film. And I also think James Wan combining this horror element with comedy and then trying to also have these stakes, it just is, it's a confusing mishmash of tones for me. But that did continue into the second one, unfortunately, for me as well. I thought the mishmash of tones just didn't work for me at all. And there are people clearly who enjoyed the movie or trying to tell you they enjoyed the movie on social media, but I thought it was an utter mess from beginning to end. Now, that being said, this may not be James Wan's fault. I think what you were referencing earlier, Michael, a lot of great ideas. But remember, they had multiple reshoots from this film. There were rumors of certain cameos showing up and then reshooting those cameos. And so I wonder what the actual original cut of this movie was going to be. And maybe that would have been a better film, or at least would have gotten the people who loved the first Aquaman film to love this film as much as they did. Because, yeah, the road buddy comedy type aspect of it, which is what James Wan teased, the chemistry between Momoa and Wilson off the charts. And Wilson, you know what? There are certain players, and I'll move Sports Reference, there are certain players that will uplift whoever they play with, right? Tom Brady, Michael Jordan. Patrick Wilson will take the limited acting talent of Jason Momoa and elevate it. And you could see here in their interactions. Did the script do him any favors? Most of the time, no. I didn't think the humor worked most of the time between them. I saw it already when it was called Thor and Loki, where it worked much better. But in this one, I felt there were moments here where at least their chemistry got me through some of the rougher jokes and stupid situations. Oh, look, I accidentally knocked down a statue. We could climb across it. I'm so smart. You know, those kinds of things that just get annoying watching a frat boy bro figuring everything out instead of learning, instead of growing, which we never got from him. You know, the arc, you know, ironically, the arc is Orm's, not Aquaman's in any way, shape, or form. And I also thought the Black Manta stuff was so ridiculous. Like, why? Oh, there's a Phantom King and I'm being taken over by this Phantom King because I want vengeance and I can't control myself. Here's this doctor who keeps walking in on me while I do this shit. But for some reason, I still keep him alive. I'll still keep him alive for no reason. And did anyone know that that was Stingray? No one knew that was Stingray. And they tried to make, was it Janie Zhao? They tried to make her really big. And you never even saw anyone address her by her name. So
one time.
One time, you're right, exactly. There you go. One time. So it's just there was just utterly ridiculous decisions made overall in the film. But I want to believe that this is because it just was so cut up that by the time we got it, it's not that great. So yeah, I want to believe that. I may be wrong, Michael. It's a fair point to bring up the noise you just made. I could possibly be wrong.
I don't know what noise you're referring to, sir.
But let me ask you about this. I mean, what Shannon, as the purported Aquaman fan, for sure, Arthur's storyline, did you like this? The fact that he was bored? I mean, he didn't want to be king necessarily in the first movie. This was kind of thrust upon him because of Orm and because like his heritage and Mera helped him. But now being king, you see that he's not happy being king. He loves being a dad. Certainly nice chemistry with his son there. Loves hanging out with his dad as well. There's a weird toast between them where they go here to single dads. And it's like, wait, are you a single dad, Barristan?
His wife's in the next room.
Here's a single dad. Hold on. The old lady's taking care of the kids so we can have these drinks.
Yeah, it feels like Thomas is taking care of their kid more than Mera is. But yeah, he's a dad, a husband, and a hero as well. So we see all this stuff. We get politics, councils, all this stuff. And then it leads to this journey here with Orm and then eventually beating Manta and going toe-to-toe with him and Manta rejecting his hand in the end. But then him coming out of this thing, a dad, a husband, a king with a better relationship with Orm. Did you like this storyline with Arthur, with Aquaman? What did you think of it?
I mean, I thought on paper, that stuff all works, that you have someone who has unexpectedly been given the throne, been given the crown, been given this responsibility. Yeah. And he finds out like this is really not that great. And I have to deal with this council, which, you know, magically appeared since the first movie. You know, it's like Congress, it's like the Senate. The
president, and there's nothing more you want to see in a superhero film than Senate or Congress or. Yeah,
absolutely. Paging Star Wars Episode One.
yeah, exactly.
But look, I think everything on paper, all that stuff works. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't executed that interestingly. Because the idea that you have this sort of, you know, this guy who's always kind of been a wanderer, now he has to stay in one place. The whole journey is figuring out how to do both, how to be a good leader, be a good king, be a good dad. and at the same time, you know, serve this, you know, kind of restless spirit. Yeah. This and restless spirit probably isn't the right word. The wanderer, like the fact that he's never had anything tying him down. I think there was probably a way to do it. I don't know if they necessarily found it.
Yeah.
But overall, like his story, it didn't really the writing did not bother me. I mean, it was, again, the moment there are advantages to going in to a film with your bar set absolutely at the rock bottom, at the bottom of the Marianas Trench. Because I was able to go in and be like, whatever they threw at me, I'm kind of like, yeah, great. Yep. Sure. Makes sense. Well, they're fighting. It did not bother me at all.
Okay. Michael, your thoughts on the storyline? Because I mean, in essence, they're kind of following the Black Panther storyline mixed in with the Thor storyline, mixed in with the Iron Man storyline, right? He wants to make Atlantis and all the kingdoms there, wants to bring them up to the surface, wants to reveal themselves to the humans so they can work together. The council rejects that idea. They just want to take over humanity when the time comes. Then you've got this back and forth with him and his brother going on this journey, his little brother, no less, and him trying to kind of figure out and repair that relationship. And at the end, he announces that he's Iron Man or Aquaman, is in essence, in that press conference at the end. So did you like the storylines here? Did you like that he had to overcome this stuff, deal with being a king, deal with being a dad and a hero and all of this? Did it work for you?
No, but let me tell you why. As a concept, yes. Like Aquaman, getting to Aquaman 2 and going, fuck, I'm not good at being a king.
Yeah.
Great. That is the next big story. He realizes maybe this is a little bit more than he's signed up for. Absolutely a great story. Here's the problem. He's not a great king.
Yeah, fair.
Orm is better.
Yeah.
Mira's probably better. Like, anyone is better. I mean, like, I know you guys were saying the last thing we want in a movie is superhero movies politics. But when you're going to do a movie that says the guy's core issue is he can't lead, but then you never really expand upon that. Like, to use Black Panther as an example, it's a very clear-cut thing he deals with, and like each character sort of represents it. Like, Nakia wants to use Wakanda's resources to help other people. His best friend, I can't remember his name right now, doesn't want them to go anywhere. His father had and then Killmonger has a very specific opinion, and T'Challa sort of learns from each character in the movie to come to his decision. Yeah. So there's a very clear thing. Thor, who also is arguably a character that probably isn't cut out to be a king, gets to the end of Endgame and says, hey, I think I'm not cut out to be a king. Valkyrie, it's yours. So you're like, yeah, that makes sense. That tracks. So when you're doing a movie like this, like, what is it? Like, yes, you get to the end and he does announce Atlantis to the world, which is what he wanted to do.
Right.
But you didn't get a sense that he learned from Orm, that he adopted any, or that he said, this is the kind of king that I want to be. He still is like, yeah, man, let's just go have some burgers and beer. I want to hang out. And he never really got to a better place. Then the whole Iron Man moment at the end just left me scratching my head, because I'm like, doesn't the world know you're Aquaman? You've been around for 3 movies.
Yeah.
Like, I know that, like, they sort of purposely were like, we're not even dealing with the extended universe with this movie. We're just going to tell this story. But this is where the non-extended universe, you're like, he's making this giant announcement. And I'm like, you've been around for a minute. Like, it kind of left a little bit of a head scratcher. I was like, I guess if this had been really a clear cut thing, again, like it was in Black Panther with Wakanda, or even like at the end of Iron Man when Robert Downey Jr. just announced it instead of keeping a secret identity, that was a big deal. But for this one, you're just kind of like, okay, so I just feel like they had a good idea, but almost because Patrick Wilson did such a good job and was so much better in this movie than the first movie. You kind of get to the end and you're like, look, I know he was the bad guy in the first movie, but he seems like a pretty decent guy. It might be better for Atlantis to let this guy lead. Go let Aquaman raise his kid.
Right. You know, by the end of Black Panther, you're like, okay, Killmonger, I don't want him to be in charge, but I respect why he did what he did, because
right.
It was the heritage and the culture and decades of all of that. But with Orm, by the end, you're like, you know what? He's learned the lesson. I kind of want him to be king. Arthur, why don't you step aside? Which is the way I felt in the first movie. Mera was figuring everything out before Arthur did. Why is Mera not the chosen person to lead? It's the Harry Potter issue. Hermione is clearly a better wizard than Harry. Why the fuck do we care that Harry's figuring things out? So it just, it's confusing to me when I see those kinds of things. I'm not supposed to cheer for the villain by the end of the movie over the hero. It's confusing. Michael, what were you saying?
No, I was just going to agree with you about Killmonger. Yeah. I mean, the other thing with Killmonger is you clearly see that he's a bad king. Like, he leads, and you're like, you're bad. Yes. Now, granted, you could argue Orm was a bad king too, but why was Orm such a bad guy? Because he wanted to invade the human world.
Right, right.
What does the entire council want to do? I kind of want to do what Orm. Like, so it's just sort of like, what, you know, and then like when Orm shows up in this movie, they go to such lengths to make him like, he's like, this is how you address people. This is how you do stuff. Like, I need, and you're just like, and because the way that they have decided to write Arthur is kind of so bro-y, think first, just like beat everybody up. You're like, okay, that's what you're going to do. But then at no point do we have that switch. Like, you get to the end and Orm's like, you are a great king. You did learn a lot. And you're like, I mean, no, he just kind of did what he did. Like,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's a little frustrating. I agree with you. Because, I mean, yeah, anyway, I don't want to get too deep into it. All right, let's go back to you, Michael. We've talked about Patrick Wilson. What do you think about how they handled Orm in the movie? I mean, we see him in the prison. Super emaciated. He is willingly being in, staying in the prison in order to keep the peace in the Seven Kingdoms. And it is until he touches water that he finds his strength, gets his muscles, kicks a bunch of ass, and then agrees to go with Arthur because Atlantis is in trouble. And we see him like grow in his conversations. We see him grow in his stature with Arthur, but we also see him learning as he goes along that Arthur actually didn't have the same mentality as Orm did. Like, Arthur really stumbled into this, and he was only doing this because Orm wanted to destroy the humans, and Orm's like, wait, you didn't want to take over? Like, you didn't want to be the king of Atlantis? So we see him slowly but surely kind of understanding that he wasn't as selfish as Orm was. He wasn't as desirous of this kind of power in order to inflict his own ideas onto Atlanteans, and that turns him around. So by the end, the bro stuff, which had bothered him at the beginning, is no longer bothersome. And like you said, he gives him his flowers or gives him his blessing to be king, which is a weird thing. Well, what did you think about how they handled Patrick Wilson's character of Orm and Wilson's performance?
I think this happens sometimes where you can see that a writer really likes a character and writes them really well, but almost so well that it like defeats the purpose of the movie. And I think that's kind of what happened here is that I think that for better or for worse, It feels like the entire behind the scenes, they kind of know what Jason Momoa's strengths are and what his limits are.
Right.
And they wrote to that. And then you're like, okay, clearly he and Amber Heard did not have that on-screen chemistry. Mm-hmm. So let's put him with Patrick Wilson. And all of a sudden I was like, oh shit, our shiny new toy, Patrick Wilson, he's got all the bells and whistles. He's the better toy. So they wrote to that. But you ended up having a character like, you know, that didn't, there was no flaws. Like, Loki is charming as hell. Arguably, Tom Hiddleston's Loki is more charming than Chris Hemsworth's Thor. And that's a tough thing to do because Chris Hemsworth is very charming.
Yeah.
But we love Loki. But we also get who Loki is. And we've seen Loki grow in his series. But within the terms of those Thor movies, Loki was great and we loved him. But we also knew that Loki was always going to go for Loki at the end. Loki was not the honorable guy that really wanted to be king. Killmonger had a very specific idea of what he wanted to do, and it ultimately wasn't going to be good for anybody. Orm's idea of leading seems pretty solid.
Yeah.
So they didn't really give him any of those flaws that said, oh, this is why Arthur's the better king.
Right.
You know, and like, and there's ways that you probably could have kept the character that you had and sort of built that in, but they needed that extra piece. And in addition to him just going, oh, wow, Arthur, it almost feels like it's around that area. Like, oh, Orm was raised to be a conniving guy who craved power. Right. Arthur didn't want power. Had it thrust upon him, still doesn't particularly want it. And there's that whole idea that the one who wants the crown the least is ultimately the one that deserves it the most. You know, there's that idea a lot of times in storytelling that had we seen Arthur we needed to see what makes Arthur the rightful king over Orm. And we needed Orm to see it too. And they wrote to that at the end. Like, they had Orm say those words, but we never really saw what it was. So I actually think the way they handled Orm was great insofar as he's probably the best character in the movie, but not great in terms of what it did to Arthur and his story.
Yeah, it's interesting, Shannon, because, like, and Michael, you bring up a really excellent point. As you said this, I remembered the scene where Orm is saying to Arthur, "My father raised me from birth to be afraid of you, to be waiting for you to show up to try to take something from me that's mine." Whereas Arthur's father raised him, Thomas raised him to, like, really appreciate that he's a man of both worlds, to find his own path, to do his own thing, and let him, of course, do the things that he did and be a bit of a wild guy, but very much have his own voice. So you see that, like, sometimes it is about environment and what you're raised around that kind of warps your mind or makes you think or certain things or makes you act a certain way in certain situations. So we see that, but that's not even explored. It's just presented and not really kind of dove into, which could be some interesting stuff that we could have gotten. Shannon, what did you think about how they wrote Orm throughout this movie and the relationship he had with Arthur? And then by the end, giving Arthur his blessings and reuniting with his mom and even giving Mara some love.
I mean, the whole idea that he felt that, you know, that there was a that moment, like, hey, you know what? You're a lot better at this than you think. You know, you have my blessing to go be king. It's like, well, it doesn't matter what you think, pal. I've already got it. but I mean, I do agree with Vogel in terms of finding those supporting characters. Not just with the writing, but also when you have a more compelling performer. What happens is that great stuff that you get with Orm sort of diminishes your lead, which is why when Thor Ragnarok came out, Thor suddenly became awesome, because they're like, hey, Thor is kind of the least interesting guy in the Thor movies, right? Because we're so into Loki. So it didn't. Again, it didn't bother me, but I do think they kind of learned some lessons from the first movie, and Patrick Wilson is just a more interesting guy. I think some place in the story, like, it's always that Atlantis was trying to invade the surface. Like, we never really got the surface trying to attack Atlantis, because for the most part, the way that it's presented, at least in this, is they don't know Atlantis is down there. Right. So it's all sort of accidental, like all the bad shit that the surface people do. They're not doing it as a deliberate attack on Atlantis. It's just because, you know, we're careless. so I think there was probably, like, you needed to have that moment with Arthur, why he, being a man of two worlds, why he is the guy.
Yeah.
Aside from Patrick Wilson saying he's the guy.
Right, right. Yeah, I would have liked to see more with Ocean Master being Ocean Master. Like, I would have liked to have seen him begrudgingly go along, know it's for Atlantis, but also be able to call out Arthur, be a harder edge to Arthur, so that his arc is even bigger in terms of the size of how far he has to come around to accepting Arthur, so that by the end, when he's giving him the flowers, you kind of can feel somewhat that it's been earned. Whereas now when he's saying to him, he's like, oh, they wrote that there, so he has to say it here and supposedly bless Arthur to be king. And you make a great point, Shannon. He doesn't need his blessing, for God's sakes. But of course you want your family's blessing. But like,
but you almost...
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Sorry, I just real quick. but like, I mean, because like there's a couple, like one of the things that Aquaman does not know anything about how the world is supposed to work as far as politics, right?
Right,
like, that's a given.
Right.
Like, we know that. And Ocean Master is a conniving villain. Very smart, knows how things should happen. But an easy, easy fix that just is like staring you right in the face is that when they go see Martin Short as Jabba the Hutt, like the way it's played right now is Ocean Master's like, I know how this works. I know how to do this. And then Aquaman just beats everybody up. But if you had just switched it where Ocean Master was like, look, I know how bad guys think. I know we need to trick this guy. We need to treat this guy bad. He's going to stab him in the back. And then Aquaman ended up drinking with the guy and they like had a great time. And you know, like, or even with like with the Randall Park thing with the doctor, Dr. Shen, the way they played it was Aquaman just wanted to beat him up. And it was Orm who was like, Yes. But if Aquaman is just the man of the people who just like knows how to deal with people better and doesn't know it, like right. Orm is the villain, even keeping him as the guy that understands politics and is a more polished guy,
yeah.
make him the less trusting guy. Make yeah. Aquaman the guy that people are drawn to, but they just gave everything to Orm.
Yeah. 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 And probably so, because Patrick Wilson is a better actor. So he can play these levels, he can play the nuance in these scenes and have it work. But I agree with you, Mike. It's a simple fix to play it that way so that he's got farther to go, so that by the end you're really excited about his turn, but you've already seen him as a villain or an untrusting person throughout. So by the end, you don't want him to necessarily be king, but you appreciate the fact that he's come around on Arthur. Yeah, yeah. I thought, but Patrick Wilson did a wonderful job.
He was great.
Yeah.
And I think something else that they could have done with Patrick Wilson is they could have made him kind of elite. Like when you think about who's going to go fight in a war, it's not going to be Patrick Wilson. It's going to be all the grunts on the ground,
right.
All the people that are not living in the palace. Like if it became more of like, you need to see everyone as an equal,
right.
You know, you still give him a lesson to learn. And that is not, that's not what happened.
I mean, another one simple right into your face is he's a pure, in his mind, he's a pure blood. Like you said, elite, a pure blood. Whereas Arthur is of two worlds, maybe not as pure. So there's something you could have played around with that as well. Let's see, where are we at right now? Yeah, let's take a quick break. We're at half an hour. Let's take a quick break. We'll jump into the Manta stuff. And yes, we'll talk about the Mara stuff on the other side of this right after that. Hello, Geek Buddies fans. Before we jump into today's episode, let's give a warm thank you to our sponsor, Marquee TV. Their support is why we're able to bring this podcast to you. Marquee TV isn't just any streaming service. They're your gateway to an incredible world of arts and culture.
That's right, Johnny. I've explored Marquee TV, and I've been amazed by their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. It is a treasure trove for any arts and culture lover. Right now, I'm in the middle of watching the Royal Shakespeare Company's production of The Tempest, and I've also got my eye on that Shakespeare masterclass taught by Dame Judi Dench.
Yeah, Shannon, and speaking of the RSC, I watched Christopher Eccleston's performance of Macbeth last night, and I'm going to jump into Kit Harington's performance of Henry V from the Donmar Warehouse.
Imagine having the world's most breathtaking ballets, dramatic theater productions, and magical operas at your fingertips. That's the experience Marquee TV offers, making the arts accessible wherever you are.
And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right. 3 months for only 99 cents with the code BUDDIES, BUDDIES. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code BUDDIES to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Get 3 months for just 99 cents. Visit marquee.tv to start your journey into the world of arts now. Use code BUDDIES.
Explore the extensive library of performances on Marquee TV today and keep up with the latest in art streaming by following at Marquee TV on social media.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Is that the, what is that one?
And it's a bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot.
Hello. Thought you're gonna do Rubber Ducky. All right, let's move on. Shannon, let's go to you. And by the way, if you're sending in Streamlabs and Super Chats, keep sending them in. We're gonna get to them in just a minute. We'll definitely answer them here in a little bit here on the show. Black Manta. Let's move on to Black Manta here. Yahya Abdul-Mateen II coming in to play Black Manta again. He gets co-opted by this Black Trident. He is taken over by this king here, this kingdom that is Necrus, this lost kingdom. Kordax is the king. Hulu Azbek from Game of Thrones there being the voice. And essentially turns him into his minion to go and perform the most horrific acts and steal, some of these elements, steal these elements to blow things up. There's some convoluted climate issue, world climate issue thrown in there that is just so frustrating when you see it. But what did you think of this, Shannon? The Black Manta storyline, was it a waste? Was it worth it? Did they really... I mean, we never get to see this villain actually kind of take over. He gets killed almost immediately once he shows up. What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, poor Pulu Azbek.
I know, right?
Literally, you got to see him in one brief flashback scene where I don't even think it's him talking. I think that's a voiceover. This guy who was very, very entertaining in Game of Thrones. I imagine that he originally had a little bit more to do. Someone wanting to a bad guy wanting to avenge their father. That is a very easy way in for a villain. But again, you've got this Orichalcum, this ancient fuel that powers these machines, but it also ruins the environment. But then you find out with the Black Trident, there's Water Mordor, and they turn the bad guy into Ocean Sauron or Sauron.
Oh, no, no, no. Even me, I must stop there. No.
it was a lot. Again, Yahya Abdul-Mateen, like if you've seen, he didn't have a giant part in The Greatest Showman, but he's great. If you watched The Watchmen HBO series, the guy's an incredible actor, and he just kind of is playing one gear this entire movie, which is what he did in the first movie. I mean, it was literally like, you're mad. That's pretty much the extent. It was the best thing to come out of the whole Black Trident thing is we got some awesome Trident duels. That was the coolest thing. I thought the action was just so leveled up, and getting to see in live action Aquaman and Black Manta fighting and also justifying why this scuba diver can take on, you know, the king of the seven seas. Like, oh, well, he's got some sort of, you know, dark power, coursing in his veins because of the black trident. It's silly. It's silly. but again, I enjoyed that.
Fair point. Yeah, Michael, are we in danger here with some of these films? I see some of these, my fellow reviewers, I see some people, some fans go, you know what? I just had fun with it. I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. But, you know, and the same thing with the Marvels. It was fun. But there's more that can happen in a comic book movie, in a superhero movie. You look at Manta. Again, here's another situation. You brought this up earlier when we were talking about Orm. Here's another situation where the writers were like, don't make him too evil. We don't want to make him too evil. Let's have him being taken over, not entering into an unholy pact. Let's have him taken over by this king and by this trident. And he's messed up in the head because he wants revenge. So he's being taken advantage of. So by the end, we actually feel sympathy when he turns down Arthur's hand and falls into where he falls into because he hasn't dealt with his anger towards Arthur. Why are they afraid to write evil characters in these fun movies? Can't someone just be evil without needing to be redeemed by the end in some way? What did you think about the Manta storyline in this film?
I don't think they did that just because they were worried. Like, I mean, look, the evil Mordor Sauron is Sauron. Pure evil. Nope. Not going to do it. But he's pure evil. It's not like they're like this whole idea that they do these
dispatched in 2 minutes, you know?
Sure. But like, I mean, look, I don't think these choices are made out of some desire to make everybody warm and cuddly. Like, this is a very old trope, and it's a trope that happens when you've run out of ideas. Like, it just makes him boring. Like, Black Manta's not interesting. Like, I think they probably did it more for the power up than for any concern about us caring about Black. Like, honestly, Black Manta wanting to avenge his dad and having a bunch of dad issues and just taking it all out on Aquaman rather than dealing with his grief actually makes him more sympathetic than running around for the entire movie possessed by some sea demon. Like, it just robs the character of anything interesting. Characters are interesting when they have really full motivations. Like Killmonger, again, we keep coming back to it because they're very similar stories, but Killmonger is a super evil villain. Mm-hmm. And also has kind of a point. Like, he's not entirely wrong. Like, Magneto is a great villain. He's also not entirely wrong. You know, the best villains are the ones that actually have something interesting. And, you know, with Black Manta, like, the whole I'm blaming Aquaman for the death of my dad is Shannon's right. You can make a lot out of that. It really wasn't ultimately Aquaman's fault. I mean, I guess it kind of was, but like, you know, Black Manta kind of
he left him to die.
His dad was a bad guy. But I'm saying, like, you know, that sustains you for one movie. Getting to the next movie, like, he definitely, and I think this is where they really run into the problem is, all right, this guy let my dad die. I fought him. He beat me.
Right.
I'm going to make this my entire life to the absence of everything else. And I think they were just like, we don't really buy it. Let's have him get possessed. As opposed to really kind of leveling him up to a different way that was more interesting. I mean, I just think ultimately anytime you see a movie where the villain gets possessed I'm looking at you, Doctor Strange, in the Multiverse of Madness. Like anytime that you go, oh, the bad guy was just possessed. So that's why we didn't have to deal with any of their character stuff at all. They were just possessed and they were bad. Yeah. That is boring. It is not interesting.
I agree. Captain America Civil War. I agree. This idea of being possessed. Yeah, I agree with you, Michael. Actually, the way you phrase it is a little bit better in how I was presenting it, but I think we're in the same ballpark in that I would have liked a more active choice from Manta. Like, I'm going to enter into this unholy union because I know I can't go toe-to-toe with him. My suit's not fixed. I'm running out of time. This is the way to do it. I'm going to finally get my revenge. And then maybe it becomes too much for him. We can approach what we get from the beginning later on down the road because he's not aware of how deep this evil goes. He's not aware of how incredibly powerful this evil is. An entire kingdom. Original king made deals with dark magic, with the unholy, with the undead, turned his kingdom into a bunch of the undead. That can overwhelm a human being because at the end of the day, Black Manta is just a human being. But he could have that power and use it till he realizes what that means for himself. And so maybe him not taking Arthur's hand is his own punishment for what he's done, because in the end, he is a man who has virtue. And the only reason he's going after Aquaman is because he killed his father, maybe before this guy found out how much of an evil person his father was. So there's things you can explore. There's richer stuff to explore here that they don't really do, which is so frustrating.
Honestly, you didn't need the whole possession angle. Like, you really didn't need that. Like, you can just have this thing power him up, and it's like, okay, now our bad guy is more powerful. Mm-hmm. And that way you kind of, you lose C-Ron. But ultimately, I'm going
to
keep saying it.
You're trying to make this happen, aren't you, Fetch?
But ultimately, that probably takes out a little bit of story time that you can devote to something else that might have been a little more useful.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. All right, Michael, let's deal with Mara. Your thoughts here. She was in the film more than I anticipated, more than they seemed to say. If you watched any of those court transcript or any court testimonies there. But in the end, still kind of an observer. They had her take part kind of in the finale, but not that much. And so were you confused by this? I mean, this seemed like she didn't even need to be in the movie, to be honest with you, with how much they cut down her part or didn't give her much to do at all in the second film. What are your thoughts on this? And if you want to comment on Amber Heard's performance.
I mean, I don't think she's in the movie enough to really comment on her performance. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that
it's fair.
I think they did themselves a disservice here. If you're going to keep Amber Heard and you're going to keep her as Mira, then use her. And if mm-hmm. you don't want to use her, then recast her and don't use Amber Heard. But what they ended up doing is they kept her in the movie and she was present at all the places where Mira should be. And she did some of the things that Mira should do, but she had no influence over Arthur's story or Orm's story or anything. Like, she didn't contribute to the story as an active member. She never had a heart-to-heart with Arthur about parenting or balancing parenting with ruling a kingdom or anything at all. Like, she just was there. She was present, but it's like, again, when you look at all of the characters in the first Black Panther movie, just again, I'll keep using the example because you have one thing that's great and one that's not, but like, you were every single character had an opinion about Wakanda and the outside world and what it meant to be a king and what Wakanda's responsibilities were to Wakandans versus Wakandans' responsibility to the wider Black community of the world. Like, every character had an important piece that led to T'Challa's arc happening.
Right.
And so when you have your female lead, I mean, arguably, I would say Nicole Kidman
is
a higher level in this movie than Amber Heard is. But when you have the character that should be your female lead, who is also the love interest, who is also the lead's wife and the father and the mother of the lead's child, and she really has nothing to say.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I mean, and honestly, it even does Amber Heard a disservice. Like, from everything I've heard, I don't think she is probably the greatest person, but it's like, you put her in this movie and you give her absolutely nothing to do. And the stuff that you gave her to do, you cut out of the movie. And if you're a fan of Mira, like, you get to see her on screen, I guess, but like, it just ultimately, it kind of is a loss for everybody, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think, you know, because whatever your feelings are personal about Mara, about Amber Heard, rather, that's left at the doorstep. This is the character. And as the character in the first film, she was a very big part of the first film, Shannon. She's the one making Arthur pay attention. She's the one going through all the different puzzles and things that they need to solve to find these artifacts to kind of prove that he is worth leadership. She is such a counsel. She fights alongside him in the final battle. But in this film, you're going to tell me that her as queen is just serves for her to wake him up when he's talking to the council. Her as a mom just serves to occasionally be there when Thomas isn't there and then freak out when their baby is taken by Manta and then later showing up to kind of participate in the final battle to save him in a critical moment, but then holding the baby at the end. Like, Mara should have been a much bigger part of this movie. Again, regardless of what your Amber Heard feelings are, she was a massive part of the first film that made $1 billion. She should have absolutely been a counsel for him to help him with the Council of the Seven Kingdoms, been a counsel for him as a mom, a counsel for him as a hero, but counsel all over the place. So it just felt like they did a massive disservice to the character of Mera, irregardless that Amber Heard is playing her. But the character should have had more, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think the most proactive thing she did was at the beginning when she redirected Arthur Jr.'s pee into Aquaman's face. Like, that was the most proactive thing she did. Now, she was great in the action because Mera's got cool powers. But outside of that, it's like she was there. I mean, Vogel, you know, we talked about it after the movie. It's like they may have reduced her contributions in the scenes that she was in, but she was there. She was kind of set dressing a little bit. And yeah, I mean, ultimately, if a performer in their first go at a character, if they don't have chemistry with your lead, then you either kind of get rid of them or you recast them. And they did neither. I mean, they were like, well, no, she's still here. We're just going to have her do way less. And it was very, very noticeable. It seemed like, okay, you may have spoken a little bit, but all of that hit the cutting room floor. But yeah, I mean, I think also because of her prior relationship with Orm, she would have a lot of thoughts about Arthur going on this adventure with him.
Yeah.
So that's, again, that's fertile ground for character development. Like, oh, we could get some good moments in here. But ultimately, I think either because of her personal life or because of her performance, they decided, well, we're going to keep her. We're just not going to do much with her.
Yeah, that's a great point, because even Black Manta brings that up, right? He says, oh, man, you didn't just steal his kid. You stole his woman. Wow. I mean, there is something to play with there that they kind of laid out in the script that you could have had some interesting conflicts for Momoa to, or for Arthur, rather, Momoa's Arthur to confront for himself. Not only do I think I'm not a good king, am I not a good husband? Am I not a good dad? There is all this stuff that you could have confronted with Arthur that could have been so rich in the movie. But of course people had fun. So why should we care about that? But I think you should care about that kind of stuff in movies. That adds to the fun, by the way. So, yeah.
Well, to be fair to everybody in the world who likes to have fun at movies,
I like, I like Transformers.
You do like Transformers. Here's what I'll say. Like, I think eating chocolate cake is fun.
Sure.
Chocolate cake tastes great. And every once in a while, you just sit, you have a piece of chocolate cake for dinner and you're like, I'm not eating anything else. I'm just having this chocolate cake. It's great. If all you eat every single meal is chocolate cake, you're going to get sick.
Sure.
Like, it just is not a sustainable thing. And so when we're talking about a single superhero movie coming out in the absence of the bigger world that we live in, and you just really loved that one superhero movie and fuck everybody's opinion, you think it's great, then you're Shannon. You're going to buy Aquaman 2 on Blu-ray. You're going to keep it around. You're going to pop it on sometimes. And that's totally fine. But when you're a studio and you're spending billions and billions of dollars on these giant interconnected universes, it's not enough for them to just be fun. Like, there has to be – you have to have some steak and potatoes – sometimes, and then you can have the chocolate cake in there, but you've got to have it a little bit. So, like, look, if you just love going to the movies and you love those things, that's great. But for this to be a sustainable business where a bigger portion of the population goes to see these movies beyond hardcore geeks that just want to see their characters come to life on screen, you've got to have some more to it ultimately in the long term than just chocolate cake.
Yeah, it's not just about critics versus fans. It's critics want to go in and like a movie. Are there some with ulterior motives? Sure, but to think that's the majority is where I kind of have to go like, man, you guys are insane. We all want to like movies. We all want to enjoy films. We want to have a good time. But if something is so obviously bad or stupid or not doesn't work, it's going to point it out. And point it out. But if you got to point it out in a way that's constructive, that's like, well, here's what could have worked. Here's what would have been better. And I kind of like that our show does that, to be honest with you. It isn't just bitching. We actually give other avenues, you know, that they could have gone down that would have made the film better or a TV show better, which I think kind of separates us out. And I appreciate that about when we have these spoiler reviews for sure. Let's see where we're at right now. Yeah. Michael, you want to say one more thing? I heard the click in the mouth.
No, that was Shannon.
Oh, that was Shannon. Shannon, what did you want to say? Sorry. Yeah.
No one sets out to make a bad movie. Like, everyone, every studio, every filmmaker, they want to go in and make the best movie that they can. Now, in terms of the people that they hire to put in charge, maybe they are not setting themselves up for success.
Right.
But no one, it's kind of like when you have those worst of lists at the end of the year. Those are really shitty. Like if we want to talk in private about the things that are like, oh boy, that movie was a turd. But going on like a public platform and just being like, just here, piece of shit after piece of shit after piece of shit, you know, a lot of people worked really hard on that. So I kind of have, I have an issue with those, but again, James Wan wanted to make the best Aquaman movie that he could.
Yeah.
But with the sun setting on a cinematic universe, a studio that doesn't know what they're exactly doing, they're not sure of the direction, what you get is something like this. You know, the original version of Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, you know, there was going to be a post-credit sequence with it. First, it was going to be Michael Keaton.
Yes.
Then it was going to be Ben Affleck. You know, they had the intention of keeping this story, trying to keep this story going. Mm. And ultimately, that is not what happens. So this is the fun day at the movies. Fun for not for everybody. The fun day at the movies that we got as a result of these sort of, you know, shifting sands of the DC cinematic universe.
Yeah, I like what Geeks and Goddesses says. They reduced Mera like Kelly Marie Tran's Rose Tico in Star Wars Rise of Skywalker. I agree. I was watching about half an hour of Rise of Skywalker, which is the first time I've watched any of Rise of Skywalker, the other day. And yeah, watching Rose just kind of be relegated to the scoff acting was just so tough to see. And so I agree with that in your assessment of Mera there as well. John Myers says, just came in knowing Michael so well, I bet he loved this movie.
You guys get me.
But you didn't love this movie. But you didn't love
it. He's being sarcastic. He knows.
Oh, okay. All right. Fair enough. I just want to make sure.
Sorry. we need italics. He loved this movie.
Yeah. Oh, fair point. That's why you should have done it. That's right. Let's hit one more thing before we go to another break and then answer Streamlabs and Super Chats. What did you think of the ensemble characters? We had Randall Park's Dr. Shin. We had Nicole Kidman's Atlanta, Thomas Curry in here, Tamara Morrison playing Thomas Curry, Martin Short as Kingfish, and John Rhys-Davies, which was great to see, here as the Brine King. As I said, Johnny Zhao is Stingray and Pilu Asbak as Kordax. And if I'm forgetting anybody else, it's because you didn't stand out to me. So, Shannon, I go back to you. What do you think of these performances? What do you think of the characters? Anything to say about these characters that stood out for you?
Well, the one that you forgot was Dolph Lundgren's King Nereus.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You're right. You did stand out to me, Dolph. Yes, Nereus. That's right. I don't trust you, man. I don't trust you. Yeah.
I mean, Nicole Kidman is doing the best that she can.
Oh, yeah.
John Rhys-Davies, like, he was acting, like, I had to look it up. Like, I didn't know that he was the Brine King in the first one, because I think the only time the Brine King spoke was in the middle of a giant action scene where he's getting his claw lopped off. look, man, they all did the best that they could with what they were given. Dolph Lundgren, maybe not his finest performance.
I mean,
Martin Short, I thought was pretty funny. And there was one other I was going to talk about, and it is just fallen out of
was
my
it head. Tamara Morrison, was it Pilu Asbak, Johnny Zhao,
was it Tamara Morrison's
Park.
Teeth Tamara Morrison's teeth.
Yeah. Oh wow,
it was Randall Park, in that I would say I prefer him as Jimmy Woo to Dr. Shin. I think playing the kind of frazzled guy that Dr. Shin was, I'm like, I don't know if I really like this Randall Park as much. I like him more as Jimmy Woo, but look, they did the best they could with what they were given. So I will not critique anyone else's performance.
I'm hitting my Randall Park limit. And I hope I can say that. He's got a shtick. The shtick is getting old for me. So I'm just saying. But yeah, Michael, what'd you think of these ensemble characters?
For reasons that I can't tell you, and it probably has to do with something I should talk to my therapist about, Randall Park as Jimmy Woo, not super attractive to me, but Randall Park in this role, kind of hot. Kind of into him.
Okay. Now, bungling professor that...
Arguably,
yeah.
Jimmy Woo is who I should be dating.
Sure, sure.
Not this scientist.
But you like broken women.
What do we think that means? I think it has a lot to do with why I'm single. So there we go. So there's there's my therapy for the day. But no, I thought all, like, I think Shannon's right. Look, I think they have some incredibly talented people in this movie. Yeah. And also Dolph Lundgren is in it. And I think that everybody did the absolute best they could with material that's kind of, and look, I mean, for this movie particularly, I mean, they're mostly on a green screen. Like, there's a lot of practical sets in this movie. And half the time they're being told, hey, you're talking to an obese, sexually ambiguous fish that's going to be voiced by Martin Short. So, like, you're just sort of like, okay. So I think everybody did the best they, you know, it's a shame because Shannon is 100% right. Nobody goes in to make a bad movie. Some people go in and do a movie just for the paycheck. And I'm sure some of the people in this movie were like, great, Aquaman 2. First movie made $1 billion. My agent got me a really great deal. I'm getting paid really well to go talk to a sexually ambiguous fish. And they were happy to do that. But I think that the fault of this movie is not the acting. The movie is not the acting.
Oh, I don't disagree with you. The fault of the movie is not the acting. I think everybody put in, including Dolph, I thought put in a decent performance to a good performance for their characters. I mean, I love the Brian King. Don't get me wrong. John Rhys-Davies, I can never have enough John Rhys-Davies. He is the new Brian Blessed. Or the, you know, he's just the same kind of thing. It's just perfect to have him as a voice. And I was going to hate the Kingfish, but, you know, I love Martin Short so much that I can't. And I enjoyed the goofiness of it all. Yeah.
That entire sequence is a great example to me of, like, a great idea. Like, yeah, sunken pirate ships where it's the one place where I do think in a movie where your king wants to bring the human world and the undersea world together, and you have all the criminals from the human world and the undersea ostensibly all talking to each other because pirates all talk to each other, there's probably more that could have been made of that. But the set was really cool.
Yeah.
The idea of it was really cool. Like, I felt like there was more you could have done with this sort of underwater Mos Eisley Jabba's Palace cantina vibe.
Yeah.
And I think they went there, they did it, but it's like, that was something where I'm like, oh, this is actually a great idea. Mm. You've got Martin Short. You've got a lot you can do here. I kind of wanted them to lean into it more.
Well, let me go back to you with that, Michael. What did you think of the cinematography? And what did you think of the music, the score here from Rupert Gregson Williams, rather, the cinematography by Don Burgess? What did you think about the look of the film, the vibrancy of the film, and then the music itself? And Shannon, please chime in after Michael.
I think Shannon's right. I think James Wan learned a lot from the first one. I think the underwater action, in general, the underwater world looked more interesting. I think they suffered a little bit. It's not to the Quantumania level of too much, but they did suffer a little bit from, I mean, Atlantis is a little bit all over the place. It's very high tech and angular and futuristic looking. It looks like the abyss in some sections.
Ooh, yeah.
And it looks like King Triton's undersea kingdom in the other sections. And there's lots of floppy gelatinous things, but then there's really hard edge things. And you're kind of like, okay, Atlantis has a lot. There's not really one architectural style to Atlantis. And then you go to this huge desert sequence with these sort of Yondu from Star Wars looking emaciated guys. And then you go to the nightmare. Then you go to this whole sort of underwater criminal den. And then you're in the volcano and then you're in underwater Mordor. So they had a lot of really big set pieces. But, you know, it's sort of an example of art direction gone wild.
Mm.
Oh, like, okay. None of the choices that were made were bad. I mean, arguably, I would say basically looking like you straight up ripped off Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings movies at the end is not the best choice. But other than that, I don't think any of the choices they made were bad choices. I just think they didn't really make a choice. They just did everything. And a really good movie, again, I'm just going to keep doing it. When you look at the way Ryan Coogler envisioned Wakanda, it is so specific and so inspired from the Afrofuturism artistic movement. And it's just a very, like, when I say Wakanda to anybody now, we all think of Ryan Coogler's Wakanda, and it's very specific. When I say the DC universe is Atlantis, you're like, which part? And so I think that's the issue.
Yeah, Shannon, what are your thoughts on the look and cinematography here, and also the music by Rupert Gregson-Williams?
Well, the production design is a lot like the script. They tried to do everything. And in trying to do everything, they didn't really service one thing. They didn't really get to feature one thing really, really well. Yeah. There are parts of Atlantis that I think look absolutely awesome. The kind of, again, water Mordor, it's so apparent. Like, it's so much like the Black Gate. It's like, that did nobody, like, there's a way to make something look ominous without just, you know, diving into your Return of the King DVD and being like, just do that, but blue. You know, the score was something. I mean, I like Rupert Gregson. What was it? Rupert Gregson
Williams.
Yeah, I like his score from the first movie. I like that there were some returning themes. I mean, that's a big thing with me as a film person. Like, I hate when the next chapter of a story, it's completely different music. Like, all these like leitmotifs for characters are gone. That really bothers me. And that is something that they didn't do. Like, they got that great theme when Atlanta is talking to Arthur about like what he's gonna have to go and do. It's like, that's fantastic. Production design, again, they tried to do everything. Cinematography, I thought it was real nice. I think they were, again, James Wan learned some lessons. He was able to kind of fine-tune a couple of things and make it look really, really, like, it was shot incredibly well. Again, it was just the stuff that they were shooting maybe not the best.
Yeah, I agree with that. I thought it was beautiful to look at. I thought Don Burgess did a wonderful job of the cinematography. James Wan, some of the direction here, making those areas, although they may be, as you said, Michael, incongruent in styles, they definitely came to life. That was never bored watching the underwater scenes in Atlantis or in whatever kingdom they were in. I liked the ingenuity of them all, and that kept my attention for sure. I thought the score was a bit much. It went overboard in certain moments. I was like, what is happening here? That it was noticeable. And again, I'm not a score whore, but for me, if it's noticeable bad or noticeable good, that says something to me when I'm watching a film. So to me, that's kind of one of the negatives for me. But overall, the look of it, I thought, was really interesting to look at. And you could be standing in awe of what they were able to conceive and come up with and shoot in the movie. All right, let's take one more break here. And on the other side, we'll have one more question for these two guys, and then we'll get into your Streamlabs and Super Chats, everybody. We'll be right back right after this.
Okay.
Shannon, your thoughts on the horror elements of the film here? We got big, large ants. We had massive creatures. We had things being sucked into black holes with tentacles. We had, as you said, the army of the dead, the Mordor situation. What are your thoughts on the horror elements? Did they fit, James Wan being a horror guy? There was some of them in the first movie, not quite as overt. It feels like it was much more overt here in this movie. What did you think about the horror elements of the film?
I mean, really, it was the trench sequence in the first movie. And I thought that trench sequence in a movie that I was not a big fan of, I really liked that sequence. I thought that was great. In terms of, like, I wouldn't really call these horror elements. I mean, again, I wouldn't say a lot of stuff in Lord of the Rings were horror elements. I'm like, these are just kind of, these are our bad guys. They look a little undead, but I think there's a ways to go before I would call them horror elements.
So undead things, not horrific to you.
In this case, no. Again, I think there was probably a way to make them a little scarier. Okay. And again, not so bargain basement Lord of the Rings. I like the idea of the underwater kingdom of the dead. I think that's a cool idea. But as it connects to Orichalcum and Black Manta and all the other stuff, it was just, again, it was like too many ideas. pick a lane and go.
Okay. What did you think of the horror elements in the movie here, Michael? I mean, we did see people getting dragged to their death. So what did you think of these horror?
I see people getting dragged to my death in RoboCop. I wouldn't call it a horror movie. but I think Shannon's right. I think that's actually the point, is that it almost feels like James Wan was robbed. Like, there's a lot of ideas in there that should be. But like, if you're going to, easy example, if you're going to do Orm and Arthur, are on a volcano island and getting attacked by giant bugs, if you set it at night, it's a horror scene and it's very scary. If you set it in the middle of the day, it's an action scene and it's cool looking, but it's not that scary. And I think that even the Army of the Dead at the end, it came across more as like this giant Lord of the Rings moment, because you had all the armies. You didn't have like creepy zombie stuff. Like, they looked creepy. Like, the art, like when they designed them, they're like, yeah, this is scary looking. But in execution, it was like, aside from like maybe the tentacle at the beginning, you know, when they like fell into the trench and the tentacle was there, and like that was scary-ish. But like, yeah, it just leaned more towards giant monster action. Even like the guys that were guarding Orm, like we were told, like they are on land and they keep themselves hydrated just enough by drinking blood, which is horrific. But we didn't get a cool vampire underwater. Like, you know, we didn't, you know, there was nothing that really like leaned towards, like, I mean, I'll say this for Sam Raimi, like, I do not like Multiverse of Madness, but his sort of B-movie horror instincts are very much on display in that movie. And I think James Wan's sort of horror instincts are muted in this and kind of replaced with, let's just go bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, that's my point. I mean, you guys are pushing back on this, but they are horror elements. Whether they work for you or not is irrelevant to whether they were horror elements. They were horror elements. They just didn't work for you guys. You weren't scared by them. I mean, an Army of the Dead being having their skin stripped off and becoming just skeletons that kill, that is a horrific element. It may not be horrific to you when you see it, but it is a horror element. So my question was, what did you guys think of the horror elements? And both of you seem to be saying they didn't work or were muted, as you just said, Michael, but they were in there, for fuck's sake. I mean, giant ants chasing you down, that is a fucking horror thing to experience.
That reminds me of a horror movie I saw called Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
And that was a horror scene. Are they running laughing? Or are they running scared for their fucking lives? They're running scared for their fucking
lives.
So
you're telling me that when someone is running and scared, it's a horror scene?
It's
as
a
cinephile.
Element. It's a horror element. Yes.
It's a horror element.
Yes. Gone Girl is a horror. Fatal Attraction is a horror. What is wrong with you?
Maybe it's a thriller. Element. It's a thriller.
Yeah. You're trying to kill me and cut my... Never mind.
I want to do an entire Geek Bite about if somebody is running scared, we're going to classify that as horror.
Of course it is. It is a horror. What other feeling? Are you thrilled by having someone chasing you with a knife? Or are you scared out of your motherfucking mind? That's a horror. You're scared out of your motherfucking mind.
This is a classic Roka double down, and I'm here for it.
Please. Are you saying you're thrilled by a woman who can slam a hammer into her face trying to take over your life? That is a horror element. For me. She's cooking rabbits in a bowl. That's a horror element.
Indiana Jones running from a giant ball that's coming down towards him is a horror element.
No, that's something. That's the consequences of actions. That's a different situation. Completely different situation. No, but who's the guy? Who's the villain in the second movie? Rami Khan. What's his name? The villain in the second movie.
Which
Temple of Doom. Temple of Doom. Temple of Doom.
Well, Temple of Doom has horror elements.
It has horror elements. Oh, interesting. Yes, exactly, because he's trying to pull the heart out of your fucking chest. That is a horror element.
That I agree.
When the arc is opened, that is a horror element, right? Because they're scared to look because the fact that he screams and his face melts off, that's a horror element.
So that is a horror element.
Yeah, yeah. That's what you're making clear. Oh, my God. All right. Anyway, let's wait, did we just take a break? We already took a break.
Jambi, but sir, this is Blackjack and you're showing 20. Roka, hit me.
We live in a world. Anyway, all right. Jim Fan says, thought this movie gave us too much Jason Momoa. Arthur talking to his dad about single fathers while Mara's in the next room holding the baby.
Yeah. And I do think they had a problem because like they just didn't give him anything else. Like all they gave him to do, the biggest thing he taught his brother was eat cheeseburgers and cockroaches, and I can't believe you've never had a slice of za, bro. Like, there, and like that kind of personality is totally fine and valid to give to your Aquaman, but they just didn't give him anything in addition to, so it ended up ringing hollow because you just kept banging the same drum over and over.
Plus, he hated humanity. Why the fuck would he have a burger or a za? You would think years being in charge as king would make him more empathetic to have an equal level conversation. It just, they went ignorant when it was convenient and smart when it was convenient. And that's frustrating when you see that in the character. Hmm. Fantastic 314 says, Orm learning to run properly, then running faster than Arthur was hilarious. Agreed. Their journey was both fun and silly, but got repetitive.
That moment was great.
Yeah, I agree. That moment was fantastic.
Mainly Patrick Wilson running like this at first. Like, it was like, that was really, really fun. That was a great moment. I give that, that moment is an A plus.
I agree. I agree. Little horror in the way he was running, for sure. Derek Johnson says, just wanted to donate. Always love watching your live shows, buddies. Definitely makes my day better. I could go on such a rant about the DCEU, but it would cost me $200 to get all the animosity I have for this franchise. That's fair, Derek. You've always been a great supporter of us, so we appreciate it. You don't need to spend $200. But yeah, gentlemen, this could be a good springboard real quick. Although Derek has one more. He said, okay, C-Ron was amazing. Had all the guys laughing. It was so bad that it was great. There you go. But yeah, I mean,
why you, Derek. Do you encourage? Why do you encourage Derek. Him?
What is our final thought on the DCEU now that it's wrapped up? And we had our legacy conversation, but now that we've seen the movie, you guys have seen the movie, what is your amended final thoughts on the DCEU after having seen the movie now? I think that's good. Just the exhale might be enough. The sigh might be enough. Is that good?
Look, it was a mixed bag. And as John pointed out when we were talking about this on the main show, they gave us some good stuff. Like, there is some good stuff in the DCEU, but on the whole, it's just such a patchwork quilt of nonsense that it's even hard to judge it as an entirety, which is actually the problem.
Oh, that's a fair point. Yeah. Yeah. How can we judge it when it was so mishmash put together? Yeah, Shannon, do you have a final thought?
Yeah, I mean, it's the Paula Abdul song, two steps forward, three steps back. I mean, every time they would find something that worked, inevitably the thing that would follow it set them back. And it was always, we said this the other day, but I mean, it was so reactive. Mm. Everything was a course correction before the ship even left the harbor. So, you know, that's not the way to tell a story, because you just don't have a clear path.
Even this movie feels a bit reactive, right? Because it made $1 billion, but it got some pretty terrible reviews. So they come back with a sequel that's a little bit Star Wars, a little bit Lord of the Rings, a little bit Iron Man, a little bit Thor, a little bit Black Panther. Let's throw it all together and see what we come up with by the end.
I wouldn't even say this was reactive. I think they looked at the first movie made $1 billion and they had all this crap in it, so like, you know what, more. Throw more.
It worked for Venom, I guess. JMB says, if you guys were execs at WB, where would you take the characters and the stories in the reboot? Would you bring anyone back or totally wipe the slate clean, etc.? Thank you. Gentlemen, who wants to answer that one?
I mean, I would totally wipe the slate clean. Even things that work great, like Viola Davis. I'm like, get a new Amanda Waller. Like, complete fresh start.
Yeah, why fuck with the audience? Just wipe it clean, start all over again. And if you don't want to tell an origin story, don't tell the origin story. We already know about it. It worked for Tom Holland's Spider-Man in the MCU. You can do that. But wipe it clean completely and start all over. That way you can be judged by everything you brought into it and built into it, not borrowing from other people's things and adding your stuff. Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, I actually don't disagree with keeping Viola Davis or Peacemaker, and I get that James Gunn has more of a vested interest in those things, and that's why he wants to keep them, but I don't really begrudge him that. I think by and large, though, just wiping the slate clean is great. I've talked to some of our friends who are not big superhero people. They see a lot of the superhero movies because we drag them to the superhero movies, but they're not really invested in the superhero universe. And when I tell them that there's just like with Superman Legacy, we're starting from scratch and it's going to be a whole new thing, you get the exact response that I think Warner Brothers wants, which is, oh, okay, yeah, like I'm in. Like I think people, like if we're like, hey, no, don't worry, this movie, The Flash is going to run on the cosmic treadmill and then Jason Momoa and Gal Gadot are going to leap over, but Henry Cavill and Ben Affleck won't be there. Like it's just who, sure, all of us and everyone listening to this gets everything I just said, but try and tell that to your uncle in Ohio. Like it just doesn't make sense. So I think wiping the slate clean and just giving us a fresh start is the best idea.
Fantastic 3014 says, Orm didn't know Arthur's reason for fighting him, like Steve didn't know it was Bucky who killed Tony's parents until Civil War. And yeah, when he did, he hid it from Tony for as long as possible.
Man, you're so upset about this.
I mean, it's, you know, people want to kiss Captain America's ass.
He apologized. He says he was wrong, and he apologized.
Yeah, I guess. Girk Pectus, I guess, says, minor thing, but I was so happy that Aquaman killed the henchwoman. I can't stand that stupid trope where the hero can murder thousands of men, but no women.
That was no woman. That was a stingray.
Oh, Lord. That is terrible. And yes, of course. Haunted _ Autumn said, although, to be fair, Stingray kept surviving all these near deaths. It was getting annoying, but by the end, they finally took her out. For God's sakes. Haunted _ Autumn says, God bless you all for attempting to dissect the turd that is Aquaman 2 and trying to find meaning in the placement of the pieces of corn.
Wow.
Jesus. Yikes, Haunted.
Listen, I will tell you, growing up as a kid, and my parents can attest to this because they had to hear me talk about it for hours. Like, okay. I think you do sometimes learn a lot more about good storytelling from the bad movies than the good movies. Like, if you watch a good movie, you watch Back to the Future, and you break it down and you can talk about all the reasons that it's great. But looking at a movie that really doesn't work and going, you can just go, look, that movie was garbage and move on with your day. But sitting there and going like, well, what does work? What doesn't work? Why doesn't it work? Why do we think they made those choices? You can sometimes learn a lot more.
Yeah. I think that's what makes our friendship always work amongst the three of us, because we don't always agree. So like listening to each other agree with, it just becomes annoying after a while. It's good to have some disagreements.
For example, your opinion about horror.
Yes, and your non-opinion about horror. $2 for Shannon's musical interludes. There you go.
Oh, God.
Thank you. I'll take it. Wipe out.
Horn Emperor says, horror elements are part of different genres. Single Fathers was for how Aquaman was raised. So praising his father, not Aquaman, I didn't like it, and the DCEU deserved much better.
It is. It is true in that scene. Like they didn't actually forget about Mira. Like Aquaman is talking about his dad, but to have two men in a movie talk about raising children and the whole single father thing and not have the character who is married and in a very strong and equal relationship loop that partner into it. Like, you know, there's, you know, like again, Mira being in that scene and saying, yeah, what you did, you know, the way you raised him is so much better than the way Orm was raised. Like, there's so many things that Mira could have contributed and it would have made it feel equal, but the absence of the other parent in that scene was noticeable.
Yeah, and I also think it's a deficient belief because, yes, he was a single father to a degree, but Atlanta didn't want him to be a single father. She had other things that kept her underwater in the kingdom, and there was reasons for why she did what she did. It would have been nice to have like maybe a later scene between Thomas and her, like after he's been shot, maybe she's nursing him back to health or whatever. It would have been nice to see more with both of them, Tamura and Nicole. And unfortunately we didn't get that. And that could have been addressed, you know, that would have been an interesting connection to that scene. When they're talking about single fathers. Emmanuel Roberson says, besides the Black Panther 2, Across the Spider-Verse, BP2 is, I hope it's, by the way, Across the Spider-Verse, the Guardians, why the last 2 years of comic book movies went silly and fun without the emotional weight? This is a very good question. What do you guys think about this and why this might have happened here over the last few years?
Go for it, Mikey.
I think that it kind of proves the point that I don't think any filmmaker, Shannon's point about no one tries to make a bad movie is true.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you that no one spending 2-3 years making a movie from development through production through release goes, you know what? I just want to make something fluffy. I don't really want to say anything. Let's just make some fun action sequences and string them together. Like, nobody does that. Yeah. Everyone wants to make something that actually says something. And it can say something light. It can say sure. something easy. But, like, when you're using – you're saying Black Panther 2, Across the Spider-Verse, and Guardians 3, every other comic book movie went silly. I hate to break it to you. Guardians of the Galaxy 3 and Spider-Verse are very silly. Like, they have some huge comedic scenes. They're very, very funny. They just happen to also have a point and actually want to say some things as well. So, I think that when you go to a movie, as Shannon did with this one, and you go, I don't give a shit, I loved it.
Right.
I had a blast and I don't care. That's super fine. But I don't think that that is a studio, nor a director, nor a writer, nor a producer's intention in making a movie. I think that, yes, they want to entertain. Yes, they want to have a good time. Yes, they want you to laugh. But I think they also want to go, and, you know, I said a little bit something. I said a little something about the importance of family. I said something about why we choose to do the things we do. You know, I think that that's inherent in it. And I think all three of these movies have that. And a lot of the other movies that came out didn't.
Yeah. Shannon, your thoughts on this?
Yeah. I mean, unless you are bankrolling a film yourself, you are paying for everything, then people that at the studios, at the production companies, people have opinions. People will, you know, they're going to offer thoughts here. They're going to offer thoughts there. And sometimes you might go in and have this great idea of what you're going to do, but sometimes a little thread gets pulled here and a little thread gets pulled there. And what started as this thing that you thought was so fantastic, it suddenly starts to get compromised. Right. And like there was a multicam sitcom I did many years ago that as we were on set, we were doing a read through and it is dumb. Like, I am not the audience for this show. But it was absolutely ridiculous. Everyone in that room, especially the ones in the suits, are cracking up because they have been sold on a vision, and in their heads, like, we are making something great. And sometimes that's why they do test screenings because it's a small group of people that are seeing this film and being like, huh. Did this not turn out the way we thought? Let's show it to some people who have no idea what they're about to see and see what happens. Yeah. Again, sometimes things work out really well and sometimes they don't. And it's again, unless you are the only person making all the creative decisions, other people are going to have opinions.
Yeah. And I've come to the thing, you know, as you guys are talking and I'm thinking about this question, it occurs to me that maybe, and I don't have any empirical evidence for this, but maybe the reason we're suffering through one of the big downturns in superhero films is because most of these have been fun without being weighty. And one of the reasons people loved those first few phases of movies is because, as Michael said, they had something to say. There was something weighty about them, not overwhelmingly weighty, but certainly weighty in what it was trying to say about parent and child relationships, about finding your voice in the world, about making a stand, about confronting evil, about coming together and working together, overcoming each other's differences, accepting each other. Those things that are a huge part of what makes a lot of these superhero films work, because yes, everyone's in tights and it's fantastical, but there's human elements that you can connect to, universality of experiences or conflicts and challenges that we all go through, no matter whether we have superpowers or not, that make them connectable. And I think we've gotten lost in the fun stuff. And too many people are saying nowadays, like, oh, can't we just have fun at the movies? Sure. But when it becomes the predominant approach, that's when you start to lose the weight of a type of movie. And I think that may be what's happening now as people are starting to turn away from superhero movies more and more. So, but as it, I don't have empirical evidence to support it. It just feels that way looking at it. We do have one stream live that came through from Hoth Security Guard. This is nothing to contribute other than I borderline hated this movie. It's so bad, it's boring. Thanks for all the videos you all have given us. Happy holidays and enjoy the new year. And Past Lives and Flora and Son were my two favorite movies of the year. Just wanted to publicly say that. I will agree with you on Past Lives. It is fantastic, very moving. It's in my top 10. But Flora and Son I have not seen yet, which is on Apple TV, and I look forward to seeing that one because I enjoyed his previous movies, John Logan's previous movies there. So, gentlemen, any comments on Past Lives or Flora and Son? Have either of you seen it?
Not seen either yet.
Okay.
I've heard Past Lives is very good.
I cannot recommend that enough. It's really good. Hunter_Autumn says, Happy New Year, Geek Buddies. You three have truly been a light in the darkness for me over the last few months. Much love to you all and everyone here. Never stop humming, Shannon.
Ooh. I agreed with 90% of that.
Just keep humming. All right. So last comments. Let's go. Let's start with you, Shannon. Final words on this movie as we wrap up our spoiler review, because I don't think there's much more to say here.
I mean, this one is going to be a guilty pleasure for me. There are some films that I have down in my little movie library that are not good movies. Some movies I actively didn't like, but because I liked a portion of it, because I wanted to support a property, I went and bought it. I got the Blu-ray for A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen just a little further away. And so, yeah, I am absolutely going to buy Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom when it comes out, because I want to have it. I want to have it next to the first Aquaman movie that I didn't love either in my little shelf here. Yeah, I mean, I agree. Like, is it okay to go and just have fun at a movie? Yes. Could this have been something else? Yes. But ultimately, as a lifelong Aquaman fan, I can't believe we got two Aquaman movies and one of them made $1 billion. So this is not a movie for everybody. It is not particularly good, but I sure had a lot of fun in it. So happy holidays.
There we go. Michael, your final words on Aquaman and Lost Kingdom.
Well, I will not be revisiting Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, but I will say this for the movie. It is the end of the DCEU, and for that, I will always like it just a little bit. While Shannon will go and revisit these movies, I am the mayor of the Munchkin City singing Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, Bring on Superman Legacy. Like, I am ready, and I am going to watch all of the good DC stuff. The Christopher Nolan Batman films, Donner's Superman, Batman the Animated Series, Justice League Unlimited, Superman and The Adventures of Superman and Lois. Like, I will watch all of it until we get to Superman Legacy, and I can't wait to talk about that.
Yeah, for sure. 2025. Put a pin in it. We definitely will. Yeah, I'll say this. To me, I just felt bad watching the movie. I'm like, you could tell that this was it and it was over, and you're like, you know what? Not that they were going through the paces. It was more like, it felt like, you know, you just feel bad watching someone try to do well and they keep failing at it. And that's what I felt when I was watching the movie. And by the end, I just was like, okay, they did it. It's done. Let's move on. We got through it together. Now let's move on. I don't think I'll ever watch this again. And I don't put it in the pile with Rise of Skywalker, which I refuse to ever watch fully again. But I certainly think this is one that didn't quite live up to what I was hoping to see, although I didn't like the first one, I appreciated the expansive nature of James Wan's approach to this Aquaman world, really laying out these incredibly distinct kingdoms. The fact that we didn't get that here and it became a much smaller story, to me, was a bit of a detriment. And I would have liked a bigger story to be told, a more expansive story to be told, that I think could have been fun to explore. But in the end, you know, they did what they did. They put the film out. Unfortunately, it's not going to make any money, I don't think, in the end. But we will see. We will see.
$40 million opening weekend? Is that what it was? Yeah,
but it's made $150 million globally. So it may end up being the film that makes the most of the DC films over the last four films. So we will see.
May I pose one question before we leave? Sure. Looking at the DC films, the last four films that we're getting in the DC Extended Universe, how would you rank these four films?
So you're talking Black Adam?
Nope, that was a year before. So okay. Shazam 2, Flash, Blue Beetle, Aquaman 2.
Blue Beetle, Flash, Aquaman 2, because I fucking hated Shazam, and Shazam at the bottom.
Mikey?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably right.
Flash more than Aquaman?
It's Blue Beetle for sure is the number one for me. Mm. Don't think it's a perfect movie, but I think it's a charming movie.
Agreed.
It's the one that I would like to watch the most out of the four. The Flash and Aquaman is tough because it might go Aquaman the Flash for me. It might go Aquaman the Flash for me just because I think Flash is such a bigger swing and a bigger disappointment. And Aquaman, I kind of went in knowing what it was going to be, and it kind of was what it was. Like, I don't think it's good, but ultimately, if you force me to sit down and really say, dude, would you rather watch The Flash or Aquaman 2? Like, I might watch Aquaman 2 just to watch Patrick Wilson run that way with his arms. And then Shazam is at the bottom just because it's just like, what even is that?
Yeah. What even is this? That'd be great. Shannon, what's your ranking?
Oh, yeah. Number four is definitely Shazam. Number three is definitely The Flash. It's been a minute since I've seen Blue Beetle. If I watch Blue Beetle again, it'll probably creep up to number one. But for right now, Blue Beetle is number two. And because I'm a diehard loyal fan, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, that is the DC movie of 2023.
Oh, Shannon, come on.
Now that is a horrific element. All right, let's get out of here. Thank you all so much for joining us. We appreciate you all madly. And of course, we hope you had a wonderful holiday, however you chose to spend it. And of course, look, keep watching us all week. We got more reviews coming up, but we certainly do want to wish you all, any of you all who are maybe traveling over the next few days and going to be tuning out from stuff, to have a happy holidays and a safe Happy New Year as well. But we appreciate you all hanging out with us here. Shannon, what do we have to tell them?
Yeah, if you'd like to follow us on social media, on Twitter, it's @geek_buddies, on Instagram @the_geek_buddies. If you'd like to follow me on social media and tell me that I'm wrong about this movie, on Instagram, it's @ShannonTheGeekBuddy, on Twitter, @Shannon_McClung. If you would like to follow Mr. Vogel, it is @MKToon. If you would like to follow Mr. Roca, it is @TheRocaSays.
Mr. Mikey?
Well, look, we like all kinds of opinions here, as you can tell, because Shannon thinks Aquaman 2 is the best DC movie of the year, and we're still going to hang out with him. So whatever opinion you have, we welcome it. And here's what you can do for us while you're listening. You can smash that like button below, subscribe to Johnny's Outlaw Nation page, leave your comments below. If you're watching this video later on, let us know what you thought of Aquaman 2. If you're listening to us on a podcast, leave us some stars and some comments so we go up in the rankings. And as always, the best thing you can do is retweet this video, post it on your socials, and tell your friends to hang out with your buddies, the Geek Buddies. What are you laughing about?
I'm laughing at Amblin Soul said, guys, go give some constructive feedback to Shannon's socials. Then the next message, he apparently needs it.
Oh, Cheryl. Cheryl, you're a pill. Thank you very much, Cheryl. All right, well, there you go. Thanks for the lively chat, as we just experienced. Thanks for the Streamlabs and the Super Chats. We appreciate it madly. And yeah, as where is it? As Fredtastic said, hey Momoa, turn off the lights when you leave. It's the end of the DCEU. Take care, everybody. We'll talk to you next time with a brand new spoiler review episode here from the
Geek
Buddies.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the spirit?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course.
What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.